Good morning, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order. Today is February 13th, 2023. It's 9:01 a.m. With me today, Senator Olson, Senator Wilson, Senator Merrick, Senator Keel. Senator Bishop will be joining us late. He got weathered in Fairbanks, and Senator Hoffman will not be joining us today. He's got a event in Anchorage, at the fish camp in Anchorage. So we're going to have today one work item on the agenda. We've invited the permanent fund to come have a conversation with the finance committee, go over the fund itself, and then spend some time on earnings reserve account. And the earnings reserve account is the spendable portion of the permanent fund, not protected by the Constitution, and just requires a 21-11 vote and a signature by the governor to spend. And the concern there is the volatility within the earnings reserve, the mechanics of how it works, and if we, which we do, rely heavily on the earnings reserve for funding the dividend and helping with the state expenditures. And we need to be very cognizant of the impacts if we cripple that instrument. The dividend will be substantially impacted along with other things around the state. So that's something that has got our attention. This will probably be one of several times over the next couple months the permanent fund will be in front of us talking to us or ledge finance about this subject as we work on our cash models, because we've asked for sensitivity analysis run and probability or probability statistics assigned to it. And also I'm hoping, and some of the other committee members are hoping, that the other body will take this information up also in this presentation, and then possibly have some work sessions with the employees in the building, because there's a lot of new ones and other ones that aren't as familiar with this. So they, as many people in this building, can grasp the sensitivity of this issue, sensitivity not only to the dividends, but sensitivity to financial markets. So with that, I'd like to go ahead and ask Mr. Devin Mitchell, Chief Executive Officer of the Permanent Fund, to come forward. He has some backup with him. He's going to get him up right away. That's fine. He's new to that position. We'd like to have him go ahead and introduce himself for the record and his compatriot, Mr. Frampton, and take the presentation away, please.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Devin Mitchell. Executive Director of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. And with me today is Marcus Frampton, the Chief Investment Officer. We also have a couple of other lifelines in the benches with Paulin Swanson, who's our Director of Communications, and Val Mertz, who's our CFO. Today's presentation, well, and I guess maybe before we jump into the presentation, I have been before this committee many times in my career. I've only been in my current position for around 3 months. I was the state's debt manager and executive director of the Alaska Municipal Bond Bank Authority prior to that. So talked a lot about the permanent fund corporation and the permanent fund itself, but with a much different perspective than I have today. And as a lifelong Alaskan, I've really enjoyed the opportunity to shift gears and move into this new role where there's an opportunity to be an advocate for, in my view, what's become the state's most important renewable resource. Today's presentation is broken into three basic components: a historical component, a financial resource corporation component, and then some of the plumbing of the corporation and issues that we might be grappling with in the near term. To jump into the history, in 1968, they discovered oil at Prudhoe Bay.
It was obviously a huge find. That resulted in a lease sale in 1969 that netted the state $900 million. At that point in time, the state's budget was about $150 million. And if you look back at, again, my former career, general obligation bond official statements, the disclosure document on the state of Alaska, you would have seen information on the fur trade included as a revenue source. So that gives you an idea of the type of state that we were living in prior to this money being transferred to the state. In 1971 and 73, there were acts to provide for the Trans-Alaska Pipeline's construction, and that construction began in 74 and in 1976. I think the leadership of the day started to recognize the insatiable demand of the state for revenue, that a lot of that $900 million had been committed already. There was significant capital needs, operating needs, infrastructure needs, and I think people saw the Prudhoe Bay, the projected Prudhoe Bay curve, where we wouldn't be producing oil anymore out of Prudhoe Bay by 2000. Obviously, that wasn't correct, but that was the projection of the time, and determined that it was advisable to take some of the non-renewable resource of the oil from the North Slope and turn it into a renewable resource in the form of a savings account. And in 1976, approved a constitutional amendment to provide for the creation of the permanent fund. The first deposits in 1977, and then the corporation created subsequent to that to manage and invest the fund in 1980. So the permanent fund constitutional amendment requires, in a lot of ways, easiest just to say royalty, 25% of royalty revenues is constitutionally dedicated to deposit into the permanent fund, but it's a little bit more than that with mineral lease rentals, royalty sale proceeds, federal mineral revenue sharing payments and bonuses received by the state. And the intent was to provide, again, an intergenerational resource for Alaska and Alaskans. And so principal, as of December 22, has grown to $52 billion. And there's different ways of describing principal. There's principal as it relates to that portion of the fund that's constitutionally protected. And then there's principal as it relates to the designation of principal, which would include unrealized gains in investments of the fund, which was an accounting and financial approach that wasn't used in the same fashion that it is today back in the mid-1970s. And so the accountancy rules have adjusted so that now when you're going through your financial statements, you'll see a disclosure for unrealized gains, and you might not have seen that at certain points in the past. So there's just been changes to the world and how, and from a financial and accounting perspective, that our statutory and constitutional framework haven't kept up with. The income produced from the fund transfers over to the earnings reserve account, and that's through statutory net income, realized gains through either the sale of assets that have increased in value, dividends, interest income, or rental income, lease income. And so that's totaled over $82 billion, which has been used for the purposes defined on the bottom. Inflation proofing, some money going back into the principal, $18 billion. There's been special appropriations to principal, including one of the checks that's on the side of the room. And there's the Alaska Capital Income Account, which is a sub-account within the permanent fund related to a court case where the judge, the defense was a group of oil firms that the state alleged had underpaid on royalty revenue in part, and the defense was or argued that the jury would potentially be biased by the impact of a deposit into the permanent fund as a result of that, of a settlement and royalty revenue flowing into the permanent fund itself. And so the judge required that that settlement be segregated from the rest of the fund. And so we have this $424 million sub-account of principal within the permanent fund at this point that's called the Amerita Hess settlement piece and generates revenue that's provided to the Alaska Capital Income Account based on some statutes in the early 2000s. The dividend fund has received $24.4 billion, and then the POMV, which is just from FY19 but through FY23, is $15.9 billion. So an increase in the reliance on the use of the fund in the last 5 years. And then the next segment, just managing investing for intergenerational benefit. So the fund, and this is really getting into Marcus's territory, and I'm going to quickly give the floor to Marcus to speak more in-depthly on investments. But in general, the strategies of the fund are long-lived. It's not a market timing organization. There's a lot of thought that goes into the investment decisions in a very methodical process that our board reviews annually. Marcus has the ability to adjust within the asset allocation and investment policy that the board provides with limitation, and those strategies of finding value for long-term investment strategy is the message that I've heard in my time at the permanent fund to this point. Whether you're talking about equities, or you're talking about fixed income or real estate, we're looking for opportunities to add value on a long-term basis. The primary purpose of the corporation that sometimes isn't spoken of enough is to protect principal. So that's job number one, is to protect principal. And so there's a constant tension between maximizing return while protecting principal. And it's not just Marcus and his team that go through this analysis. We also have a risk officer, a chief risk officer that Marcus works with closely, but sometimes has to have heated discussion with about how to maintain that balance and ensure that we're conforming to that duty to protect principal through time.
So maybe before we go to the next slide on intergenerational, if you could help me a little bit on the, before we went to percent of market value, how the dividend was calculated. It still is today, that formula in the books, and that split was to go, my understanding, that net split half to the dividend, and then I think possibly to inflation proofing, and then the remaining balance to the state, or some combination there. If you can help me with that, because my recollection is the state never took their portion out. They constantly reinvested it and didn't spend it, the previous legislatures, for the vast majority of it, other than from some operational costs at the permanent fund itself, thereby enhancing the growth of the permanent fund for almost 40 years.
Mr. Chair, that's entirely correct, that the two statutory formulas for drawing money from the permanent fund, the first is the historical 21% of the last 5 years earnings, statutory net income, I should say, because it's not GAAP earnings, and then dividing that in half being for the permanent fund and half theoretically available to the state. And like you said, the state simply saved the portion that could have been spent on services for that year's residents. And that's one of the points that we try to make in this presentation and subsequent slides, is just that gift and sacrifice that the past generations of Alaskans have made to provide the resource that we now have in front of us today, that it wouldn't exist in the way that we know it without that sacrifice. And the obligation of today's generation is similar to that of the past, that a failure to adhere to prudent policy and restraint would result in taking wealth that people set aside not for us, but for Alaska in perpetuity, and really taking from each generation that comes after us. And so it is a very important concept to me after having made the transition to the permanent fund corporation in particular, but as an Alaskan as well.
I just think that point is very rarely brought up in the building or even in public, that the state for decades reinvested their percentage and by some estimates almost doubled the market value of the permanent fund over those decades. So we can put a finer point on that as we go down. I know a lot of folks around the state probably don't want to hear it or admit it or even recognize it. But it is, in fact, history will prove that's exactly what's taken place.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Mitchell, as you look at the previous slide where you talk about the 25% of the royalties, which have essentially been $52 billion, and you look at the ERA, which has contributed $82 billion over a period of time, does the permanent fund board or the permanent fund administration look at those two numbers differently at all?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, I'm sorry, I was messing around trying to find the slide you were talking about, and I think I missed the a basic tenet of your question.
It has to do on slide four, actually. Okay. Where you talk about the principle of the 25% of the royalties that were put into the fund is roughly $52 billion. As you look at the earning reserve, roughly $82 billion has been put into that. I'm wondering, does the permanent fund board or the permanent fund administration look at those two numbers differently?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, yes. So the principle is a combination of deposits that include the constitutional and statutory royalty revenue, which in combination, there's a slide here within the deck, it's around, it seems like $19 billion. And so that's how much money would reside in the permanent fund per the constitutional amendment, plus the statutory contributions that have been made in addition to that since the mid-1980s. And then the balance of the fund is the result of either appropriations from the general fund, appropriations from the earnings reserve, for inflation proofing, or special appropriations. And so it's, and then the Amaretta Hess piece. But they're looked at very differently.
If I can continue, Mr. Chairman. I guess where I'm going with this is that if they're looked at differently in the Constitution, it says that we cannot touch the corpus of the permanent fund itself. But since they're looked at differently, I mean, they came from different sources, does that protection still hold up for the whole fund, or is it only for part of the fund? Because it says only the royalties. Is that correct? Isn't that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, it allows for the at least. So it's not there's no limiter on how much the state could segregate and provide into the permanent fund and then protect as principal. Mm-hmm. But it set a floor with an allowance for more. And so that's how then the additional 25% of royalty revenue that's provided by statute has been contributed, as well as all of those other special appropriations.
I guess my question, Mr. Chairman, if I could continue, is that if there was a challenge that the permanent fund corpus is protected, but only the royalty portion of it, means you're only protecting $52 billion as opposed to the rest of the stuff that's, the rest of the remainder that's there. Is that logical thinking or not logical thinking? Or is that just what the lawyers have been telling me about what can happen if there was an outright legal challenge to it?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, I've been wrong about legal opinions in the past. And so I don't want to get too far out on a limb. But my conversations with our general counsel would suggest that at least our opinion would be that the $52 billion is irrevocably placed in the fund, despite of the source of those deposits. So it's not just the royalty portion, it's the entirety of the $52 billion balance.
Okay, Senator Merritt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Mitchell, for being here, and congratulations on your new position. First, is it feasible? And second, are there any benefits to combining the principal and the earnings reserve accounts?
Through the chair, Senator Merrick, sorry. You guys are stealing my thunder.
We're going to stay in the order of the slide. So if someone asks you a question that is better answered when the slide comes up, we'll just defer it.
Okay. Yeah, we will definitely address that question. And the answer is a simple yes for now, but we'll give more detail.
So, yeah, you try to wrap up the answer and the question in the presentation of that particular slide. Okay. And you may not get a follow-up, but you may get a follow-up at the time. Any other questions? It's okay, we'll go on to slide 7.
I used to really like this slide in my old position just because it highlights the value that the fund brings to the state of Alaska, that we have a relatively small economy from a GDP perspective in the state of Alaska, but yet the largest single revenue source and most stable revenue source to the state. And I say largest single because I stretch it a little bit, and I would segregate oil tax into its component pieces in the last fiscal year as a way of saying largest. But we have investments in over 100 countries around the world, 3,000 different entities. I don't know how many different specific investments, but that revenue isn't derived based on our economy from the permanent funds investment. It's based on the worldwide economy. And that, from a credit perspective, reduces the reliance on the state of Alaska's economy, specifically for providing for the state of Alaska from a revenue perspective, which is a fairly amazing achievement, again, from the sacrifices of the past.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and maybe a question for Mr. Frampton. I'll leave it to you to decide. But when you talk about the global economy, North America is probably a quarter of that. It looks from the slide like we are three quarters invested in North America. Can you talk to us about why that difference?
I think I'm going to quickly ask Mr. Marcus Frampton to answer that question.
Sure. For the record, I'm Marcus Frampton, the Chief Investment Officer of Alaska Permanent Fund. Through the chair, Senator Keel, we'll get into each of our asset classes later, but each asset class is a little bit different story. Our largest asset class is public stocks, and our benchmark is a global equity index. U.S. stocks are now roughly 60% of that index. It used to be less than 50%. And so because the economy and the markets and the financial system and the rule of law in the United States is more developed than, for example, emerging markets, we have a higher percentage of our stocks in the U.S. than the GDP mix would suggest. With that said, among institutional funds, we're about as international as you see by using that global stock benchmark. You see some funds that have a home country bias, so it might be 70 or 80% U.S. stocks. And then in other assets, so like real estate, for example, we don't see much advantage going to Europe in real estate because we have some tax leakage. It varies based on the country, whereas in the U.S., there's very clear pass-through, no tax leakage. And so it just varies from stocks where we're most international, maybe 60% U.S., to areas like real estate where we really don't see any. We see disadvantage of being global, and so we are almost 100% U.S. So I guess that would be the quick answer to your question. We do have a bit of a home country bias, but maybe a little less than some of our peers.
Good. Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess And that's very helpful perspective to put us in relationship to our peers. Maybe to do the five-year-old thing and just go, why? Is that because that's what funds like us, like ours, just kind of do? Or is it more like the real estate example where we're looking at each and every situation? Is this a risk management thing? What are the underlying reasons?
I would say through the chair, Senator Keel, the underlying reasons are rule of law, familiarity, and the development of the financial system. So all three of those are important for different reasons. And if you look at, for example, the United Kingdom, we have a higher mix of our assets in the United Kingdom than the United Kingdom's GDP mix. And it's for those same reasons. They have, you know, we have familiarity with it, they have rule of law, and they have depth of financial markets. You could have, China is another example. It's now, you know, it will become the top GDP country, and yet 5% of our public equity portfolios in China. Some would say that's too much given the lack of rule of law, the lack of our familiarity, and a less deep market. We're comfortable with 5% of our portfolio in China, but it would be inappropriate to have the same mix in our portfolio in China as their GDP contribution, in my view. So I think there's valid reasons. It's not just, you know, this is kind of what everyone does.
Can you help the committee a little bit? In previous meetings a year ago, we talked about the exposure in Russia and where the permanent fund is on that before we go to the next slide.
Yes. We did not divest our Russian assets at the time of the invasion of Ukraine. We held a little under 200 million of stocks and bonds. Those have been written down substantially, 90%+. There have been some instances where we've seen some securities have a market develop. Some Russian corporate bonds that are domiciled out of Moscow. And there have been some situations where we sold some assets that call it 30 cents on the dollar. But the vast majority we still hold. And if we liquidated, would be down 99%. And so those kind of down 99% assets we're just holding, but we don't ascribe much value to them at this point.
Okay. Next slide.
This is Devin Mitchell again, and this slide is really just to give you a snapshot of the evolution of the fund's asset allocation through time. That at inception, we were all fixed income. And that has gradually become more sophisticated through the most current 2023 view. And Marcus will run through the detail on that asset allocation in a couple of slides. Okay. And this slide is just intended to highlight the high bar that's been set for the permanent fund and the corporation from a return objective perspective. This bar chart is a series of 10-year time frames on a historical basis. And the gold dots are the target. That's the return objective, inflation plus 5%. And so that's why it's variable, because inflation moves from year to year. And the combination of fund real return and inflation is the experience. And so you can see for the last four 10-year look backs, the fund exceeded the target. For the 10 years prior to that, it didn't. And then for the 7 years on this particular chart, it did. And so that's the cyclicality of markets and the very long-term view that's required to have an expectation of hitting the target. If we looked at longer periods, 20 or 30 year look backs, I know the 20 year, they're still in that valley. There's still 4 years that where in which the return objective is not met. When you go to 30 year look backs, it becomes 100%. And so again, just very long lived in a high target for our staff to try to achieve.
Okay, on this slide, let me preference the question. there's a considerable amount of concern over risk exposure dealing with the earnings reserve account. And we've just come off of several good years, and we got to have a few not so good years to average it out. But just looking at your slide, it looks like there's 10-year increments. These are in 10-year increments. 10-year increments where we were above our target. But there was also 10-year increments when we were below our target. And one, what looks like the little yellow dots from 09 to 18 is right on top. So it looks like the score is 10, 10, and 1. So help me understand what a range of outcomes here if we end up with, if you look back at 99, 2000, starting dates 2001, 2002, 2003, 2004, there's a lot of serial relationship there where we're underperforming over a 10-year time frame. And when we look at our 10-year plan, the concern at the table is it doesn't work if you go broke in year 5. So we got to get to year 5, and then you got to get to year 4 before you can get to year 10. So can you help me with why we should be concerned when there's 10-year increments of underperformance?
Mr. Chairman, I think that is the point, that you should be concerned that there can be time frames where the markets don't provide for the return objective. And as you just highlighted, that could be a decade-long experience. And you have to remember that in those 10-year lookbacks, there was no POMV payout from the permanent fund during that time, those time frames. It was just the half of the 21% of the average 5-year earnings, the 21% of the last 5 years earnings. And so there was a better ability to withstand those more negative market experiences and still maintain or even grow fund balance than there is with a 5% payout. And so as you're working with your partners in legislative finance who've built a probabilistic model to explore what the different scenarios of the future might provide for the fund, I think it's important to have both the expected, kind of the average expected outcome that you might hope to achieve or outperform, but it's even more important to look at the downside experiences that have occurred at different points in the past and what would happen if they happened again today.
As I recall, I'd have to go back and look, 08, 09, somewhere back in there, Senator Olson and Senator Bishop and myself were sitting at this very table. Senator Keel was an aide to the committee at the time, and some of the other workers in the room, probably in the room also, Senator Hoffman's crew, some more of my crew, we were worried about not being able to pay a dividend. There wasn't the earnings reserve there to do that. And then we had some good fortune or some creativity, combination of both, that enabled us that year to pay a dividend. So that issue has been front and center in the middle of this table before, a little over a decade ago, decade and a half ago, whatever. Let's go back and take a look at what it was. But it was a real experience, and I don't think it was a pleasurable one for the committee to look down the gun sights and see that coming at us. And that's why I bring up these, you know, these 10 times there's a 10-year increment where we would have substantial difficulty. So it's not hypothetical in any way, shape, or form here. So we'll go on to the next slide.
I'm going to turn it back over to Mr. Frampton.
Thank you. So I was going to use this slide to take an opportunity to comment on how we set our asset allocation and then our investment strategy in terms of implementing that asset allocation. So as discussed, the fund has a return objective of inflation plus 5%. And so our board each year meets to consider asset allocation and essentially is picking a mix of asset types that can be expected to earn a return of CPI plus 5. And so when we're benchmarking how has the fund done, that's the first thing we look at. And on this chart, that's the gray bar on the right is CPI plus 5. The gold bar is the fund's performance. And actually next week at our or this week at our board meeting, we're having the asset allocation discussion for this year led by our consultant, Callan. In implementing the asset allocation, we're not able to just invest in CPI plus 5. There's not a security that delivers CPI plus 5. So we pick a mix of assets. And then year to year, we benchmark our performance against that mix of assets that has been selected. We do it both on a passive basis, so that's the dark blue second bar, assumes that our asset allocation is implemented passively through indexes that are widely available at low cost. The bar to the right of that is our performance benchmark, which features the complexity and private assets that we've chosen to implement, but which may not be implementable through index passive approaches. So, for example, in real estate, our benchmark on the performance benchmark is the NCREIF index, which is a composite of appraisals of institutionally owned real estate, whereas on the passive benchmark is the public REIT index. The way I think about it is the performance benchmark, the third bar, measures whether the complexity of our asset allocation is paying off, like is having private real estate instead of REITs on a long-term basis, adding value over the passive benchmark. And then I look at our performance versus the performance benchmark as are we adding value in implementing this more complex asset allocation. If you focus on the 10-year column, the answer is a good one. The performance benchmark has outperformed the passive benchmark. So the alternatives and the privates that we've chosen to invest in have added value. And then our performance has been higher than the performance benchmark. So our implementation has added value. If I had to characterize how we invest, it's first, don't make mistakes. So we're aware of the fact that we're up here in Juneau, there are people in London and New York that are closer to the market, have greater resources. So we try to use our long-term orientation and patient approach to investing to step into situations where we're not transacting with people that have an informational edge, where just being able to invest for 10 or 20 years gives us an advantage. A couple examples of that are after the financial crisis, we set up a joint venture. This is back in 2011 to buy foreclosed homes at auction and rent them out. At the time, not too many people were doing that. It was an area that we were able to understand, not high tech, not anything special, just a dislocated market. And now rental homes has become a big institutional asset class. We've exited that investment. Oil and gas stocks over the last few years was another area. We were overweight energy and oil and gas when a number of our peers were getting out of the area. So we try to not make mistakes and then be a value investor with a long-term horizon. The last point I'll make on this page is just the last 2 years are years that we're probably most proud of. So 2 years ago, our performance benchmark returned about 27%. It's not on this page, it's embedded in the three-year numbers. And we did 29, so we beat our benchmark by 2% in a bull market, and then this last year ended June 30th, we declined 1.3 versus our performance benchmark declined 3.2. So I always say anyone can beat a benchmark in a bull market. You just take more risk. And we're very proud that we were able to outperform in last year, which was tough, a bear market. So this next page just highlights a little bit more. Oh,
run to that next slide. Help us understand the illiquidity section of the portfolio, like the real estate, how its value is put on when you are assigned when you do your financial reports and things like that, which would be much different, for instance, if you were trying to figure out what Microsoft company was worth at any given time.
Sure. Chair Stedman, for our private areas, which are about 40% of the portfolio, they include private equity, private companies, real estate, and private credit and infrastructure. The indexes are broadly appraisal-based. So on a quarterly basis, the assets are valued, in contrast to public securities, which you see a price in the paper every day. And so the reason that our portfolio did better than the passive index is these illiquid assets don't move with the same volatility of public stocks. So, you know, the S&P 500 was down close to 20% last year. I think the appraisals of our private equity companies were down like low to mid single digits. And I mean, some people in the industry have questioned whether that's valid. Like, what, you know, why aren't private companies remarked lower commensurate with stocks going down? And it's kind of a phenomenon that I've seen my whole career is stocks move with more volatility. And if the bear market in stocks continues, I think we'll see pressure on our private valuations. But the comparison versus the benchmark is apples to apples. It's our private companies versus a composite of institutionally owned private companies. Does that answer your question?
That helps. And it's a prelude to you need you to talk about when you get to that slide about the illiquid portion of your holdings when the time comes to, feed the little squirrels that want the 5%, which is us. Which is saying we have a Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I don't know if it's now or later, but that illiquid nature and the example you used sort of feeds into some of the complexity. We talk about the market value. It's hard to figure out the value of some of these things. We have our 5% draw limited on the market value, but we also have these other terms you've used, statutory net income, realized. So I wonder if selling that bunch of houses you talked about, how did that work in terms of what it did to the market value when you sold, what it did to the realized income or the statutory net income? Can you just tell us sort of how it moved those things relative to each other?
Absolutely. Through the chair, Senator Keel, in the last 10 years in the strong market we've had, and this is actually true of the last year, when we've sold assets on a private basis, it's generally been above where they were marked. When we've seen private equity funds that we invest in exit a deal, it's the vast majority of the time is above the mark, which gives me some comfort that they conservatively mark it. Now, if you go into a real difficult market, like September of this last year was when the S&P 500 troughed, if you had to sell something private fast, I mean, you would get hit hard, just like if you try to list your house and you got to sell in a week versus in 6 months. I'll address the rental home one. In that situation, it was a private company that was started. We owned 50% of it. So it was capitalized with a couple billion. They grew their portfolio. They did an IPO. And once they were public, we kind of trickled the shares into the market, and we were very careful not to have a market impact. But if we were to go dump $1 billion of that stock on the market on one day, it would have, you know, we would have had to take a discount. So we try to be very careful in how we exit assets, but still close to 40% of the portfolio is private. And if we had to sell it in a compressed time frame, it would put pressure on the value. And you had a comment or a question on statutory net income, the realization. If you look at, I think we may have a slide on statutory net income, but it's been fairly lumpy over the last 10 years. There was one year where it was an outlier high, and that year we exited a very large portfolio of apartments, multi-billion dollar portfolio at a very large gain. And so there is that lumpiness. When I look at unrealized gain by asset class as of December, the over 90% of the unrealized gain is in our private portfolio. Our fixed income portfolio is a little under $1 billion, I believe, and our stock portfolio is like $1.5 billion. And there's around $10 billion in privates. So before the S&P was down 20% last year, we had health and interest rates went up. We had healthy unrealized gains in stocks and bonds. And as we turned the portfolio over, it was generating realized gains over statutory net income. Today, where the unrealized gains sit, as we turn the portfolio over, we're not generating as much out of our public portfolio. And then exits of private companies have slowed down in the last year as the markets have been tougher. So we've seen, like private equity, for example, the exits of private companies are down 50% year over year because it's not as good of a year to sell a private company right now. And that's why the year-to-date statutory net income is lower than what we've seen in past years, those factors I just described. Does that answer your question?
Mr. Chairman?
What?
I think it answers my question and three others. So I appreciate the level of detail. I guess when I look back at slide 8, if I understood right, and I do not have your expertise, so tell me if I simplify this to the point of wrong, that pink wedge and some of the other private stuff that's hard to figure out the value of, I think you used the word lumpiness. And if I understood what you said right, I think the takeaway was when you decide it's time to sell a chunk of that, it moves the statutory net income all over the place, and it doesn't particularly change the value of the fund. Did I get that right?
Through the chair, yes, that's right.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I bring that up because the statutory net income is how we figure out the dividend, the old dividend check formula that people talk about, the 40-year-old formula. But the value of the fund doesn't necessarily spike and drop like that. That's what I'm trying to suss out here.
So let me kind of rephrase this. I think in 2000, FY 19 and 20, there was about $3 billion in statutory net income. And then around 21, FY 21, I sold a bunch of real estate and it went up to $7.9 billion. From $3 billion, low $3 billions, to $7.9. That shoves the dividend calculation up, the dividend to the people, the statutory dividend. And following the 7.9, I think it was 5.6, and then in the 4 billion, it was still significantly above, you know, in 19 and 20, before 19 and 20. Now what Mr. Frampton's mentioning here to the committee, as we're looking at more historical numbers in the 2 billion, 3 billion range, which will bring that statutory formulated dividend down, because that's what triggers it, the calculation versus the percent of market value, which is just a 5% draw and some split of that numeric to the citizens in the state. So when we went from $3.1 billion to $7.9 billion in 1 year, the permanent fund was cautioning us at the time that that was coming. And then after it was triggered, they showed us the numerics and explained why. And now that's getting in our rearview mirror, and we're getting into the more historic range, although we got to, I guess, take into account the portfolio is larger than it was in FY19. But it does significantly move the statutory dividend calculation. And we'll hopefully get into that a little bit, or we'll get into it a little later with more detail, because that is an important point, along with the state not taking their 50% out and reinvesting it. These make huge differences on the on the dividend formula. And for those that want to reference that, there's a on the permanent fund, on one of your pages, they have the historic review of the permanent fund and valuation, inflation proofing, realized gains. The, I think it's a historical, I forget what you title it, historical look back or whatever it is. But it's there, and it'll have a table showing these numerics I just mentioned on the bottom of the page, along with the 5% payout, and what those numbers are. So they're readily available to the public, but I don't think too many people look at it or even recognize what they're looking at. All right, go ahead and continue.
So just to spend a minute on this page to further explain how the benchmarks work, this is our internal fixed income portfolio, and there are six subcomposites in that, six areas of bonds that we trade. And I'm showing on the right there the five-year performance of our internal management of these portfolios against the benchmark. We've beaten on five out of the six. And within each of these areas, we've got portfolio managers and analysts that are reviewing all the securities available to them and underweighting the bonds that they think are expensive, overweighting the bonds that they think represent value. Our fixed income team is also very active on new bond issuance. So they go out to New York a couple times a year to stay current with the investment banks, and some value is added by getting concession on new issue bonds. They issue bonds a little cheaper than where you can buy them on the secondary market. And so if you looked at any of the asset classes, you'd see the same picture of subcomposites and then portfolio managers and analysts assigned to areas within the asset class, each being measured on their performance versus benchmark. And then our director of fixed income further weights these six areas based on where he sees value. And when you add all those up to the total fund, that's generally how we're beating our benchmarks. It's generally not big market bets. It's generally grinding out performance security by security and then adding it up throughout the fund. We have had some focus on bringing areas that are outsourced to external managers internal. In the last 10 years, I've shown seven areas there that we've brought things in. We try to be very deliberate when we do this. It doesn't make sense to bring something in-house just for the sake of bringing it in-house. It has to be an area where we think we can add value and from largely from Juno manage in a manner that we can beat our benchmark. Fixed income is a good example. In 2018, we started trading high yield bonds. That was an area where we had always hired managers. Those are the least creditworthy corporate bonds that offer a little higher return. So we brought that in-house in 2018, and then in 2022, we brought all of fixed income in-house. The remaining areas after high yield were global sovereign bonds, which we brought in-house. Then we also had emerging market debt, which we stopped that mandate. And so with those moves, we brought all the fixed income in-house. That saved about $8 million in management fees. There are a number of other examples, but the point is just that we try to be very deliberate and try not to get out over our skis on things. On the left there, I've showed our asset allocation with the number of FTEs we have in each area. We've got a fairly lean team, I would say, for our mandate, but we try to stay very efficient.
Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You talked about some of the bringing some of these items in-house and saving the $8 million. And, you know, this is just making sure that we're just not talking about the successes, but have we failed in any areas that you brought anything in-house?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, I don't think that there's an I think we've been deliberate enough that when I look at everything on that page, it's been a success story. I can't think of an example where we brought something in-house and kind of stubbed our toes.
Right. Thank you.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was going to ask you to define some more terms, but I'd rather follow up on Senator Wilson's question. Does that mean we're not moving on enough places that we haven't found any place we're not good at yet? Should we be a little more assertive and willing to back down if we make a mistake?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, I think that's something that Mr. Mitchell and I will spend some time on. I mean, it is kind of the obvious question. If you each one of these initiatives saves millions of fees. I think equities, public stocks are an area we've been focused on. We're about 15% internally managed on public stocks, and there's room to grow there. We spend over $100 million a year in external public stock managers' fees. So that's a three-person team. So, I mean, that's an area we're looking at, but we're just very cautious because you mess something up and it offsets, you know, years of good work if you know. So I think it's the fair question to ask.
But let's not manage the fund till we break it.
Mr. Chairman,
we have enough problems here with broken things. We've got to break the permanent fund.
Curiosity, not a push.
Yeah. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As you look at this pie chart that's over on the left, I guess one of the questions that I do have, and I probably should have asked it before because it's referenced in slide 8, what exactly is the absolute return, which is the sixth bullet down there that's at 9%? Can you define that for me?
Sure. Through the chair, Senator, absolute return is commonly referred to as hedge funds, which can mean a lot of different things. But for us, it means external managers that manage money with zero correlation to public markets. So the largest area are stock managers that short exactly the same amount of stock that they're long. So in other words, their whole return is how well they pick the stocks. It's not where did the market go. Another area we have there is macro hedge fund managers. So George Soros is the most famous. He famously invests in different currencies. And so we have managers that have track records trading commodities, currencies all around the world in ways that just don't relate to how traditional markets do. And that's an area that we brought in-house. We call it hedge fund of fund management. When we first wanted to get into absolute return, we hired fund-to-fund managers and we're paying them. And then in 2015, we decided that we could select those managers ourselves.
Last question, Mr. Chair.
Yes, go ahead.
Has that been profitable for the fund?
It has been. During the bull market, if you look at the last like 5 or 6 years, it's returned 5 or 6% net of fees. When stocks were doing really well, there was always a question of, is this a good use of capital? The real test was last year when the stock and bond markets were down, and that absolute return portfolio returned about 8% last calendar year. And so it really kind of proved itself out. So that's one of the areas of the portfolio that we expect to make money in any environment and is worthwhile.
No further questions, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Next slide, please.
I'll just spend 1 second on this. In addition to looking at benchmarks, we also are judged relative to peer funds, in this case, large public government funds in the United States. This page is from Callan. And you see under member count, they track 72 funds that are large public funds over $1 billion. And we've been top decile over the last 3 and 5 years in that group. And that group includes some funds that have more aggressive asset allocation than we do. So we're very proud of this page. And this last page I'll just finish on is just to give our stakeholders some confidence that we have a very experienced team. We've had good stability on the investment team and generally are able to recruit folks that have some mix of private sector experience but want to move to Alaska for the mission and for other good things about the working for the permanent fund. So we have a very strong team.
And just on that, on the performance or the comments earlier, maybe a year ago, with the real estate holdings that you guys were looking at trying to improve that asset allocation arena or sector, I should say, performance relative to the benchmark and overall. So how is that working or going?
Yes, Chair Stedman. If you look back the last 5 or 6 years, real estate was our toughest area. Last year, we beat our benchmark in real estate. It was probably the first year in the last 5 or 6 years where we did. So that's been a good outcome. And I think that that's an important area of the portfolio with inflation and other issues. So we're happy with where real estate is now.
Okay. Go to the next page. Next slide.
So we're moving back to Devin Mitchell, Executive Director, the enduring financial resource portion of our presentation. And I would just echo some of Marcus's comments about the investment staff and the strength of a bench that exists at the permanent fund. And it goes beyond just the investment staff. There's a very strong team of professionals that back the investment officers and allow them to do the work they do. And a lot of the questions that just kind of surface in a lot regarding how the fund works as it relates to investment strategy and maybe liquidity issues aren't really part of Marcus's mandate. Marcus's mandate is to keep the money safe and maximize return. And he doesn't have a mandate, and really nobody at the Permanent Fund Corporation does, to provide for the state's requests, even though that's a tenet that we are all aware of and we manage to. It's not built into our construct. So it's a little bit of tension between trying to just work in isolation and accomplish the mission, which is maximum return with as little risk as possible, but then being responsive to the needs of our organization. So a financial resource for Alaska, and we've talked about this a little bit. We have a board of trustees that ultimately is the fiduciaries for the fund. Six members, they serve, four of them serve four-year staggered terms. The other two are part of the governor's cabinet. The Department of Revenue is always an assignee, and then one other member at the governor's discretion. The concepts on this slide are that we're working to invest the money in as prudent a fashion as possible for that intergenerational benefit for today and the future. From a state revenue perspective, this slide shows the impact and that POMV distribution that I referred to earlier as the largest single revenue source that the state receives. And the formula for its determination is on the right, the average of the last five completed fiscal years, 5% balance. And that draw for it becomes then a very predictable revenue source for the state, since when you roll into session, you already know what that amount's going to be. It is unlike a projection of a price of oil and a volume of production for FY24, a certainty. The projections after 2024 obviously just that, and based on Callan's midterm, and so you can see the outcome of the projected revenue stream into the future.
It looks relatively flat. Can you help us with that? As far as the chart, you know, you have petroleum revenue and unrestricted general fund, so it's hard to get a good visual graph on that, but it looks like the permanent fund's rather flat.
Mr. Chairman, there's slight growth in the POMV transfer. I think it's hidden in this bar chart by the slight contraction of the other two categories of petroleum and other UGF. So we could show it to you in isolation to make it more clear what the projections, the mid-case projections are for the POMV transfers of the future.
That would be helpful, because the concern is the draw rate at 5% relative to the draw rate of the Alaska Mental Health, which is 4.25%, and they're experiencing and forecasting growth in their portfolio. Concern with the permanent fund at 5%, it may not be much growth, inflation adjusted, as some of us would hope or like.
Through the chair, again, I think that's a legitimate point that since, and it's, we have a slide in a couple that highlights it, but.
We could wait till we get there.
And this slide, again, responds to an earlier question about the various transfers into the fund from either royalties, and so this was Senator Olson's questions earlier in the presentations, $19 billion of royalty deposits, and that includes both the constitutional and the statutory deposits. The majority is constitutional, but still absent the additional efforts of the past generations of Alaskans, that would be the balance of the principal in the permanent fund if there hadn't been inflation proofing and special appropriations. And so you can see the total of those in $15 billion and $18 billion respectively. There's a projection for 2023. Inflation proofing is appropriated for FY23 in the budget. The royalty revenue flowing into the fund is reliant on the price of oil and production from the North Slope.
Do you happen to know what that request for appropriation is in dollars, roughly?
For FY23, it's $4.2 billion based on 22 and 21's inflation rates.
And if we don't make that appropriation, what's explain to the public how that works, the appropriation, unless you're going to do it later, and the mechanisms of the corpus of the fund versus the earnings reserve.
And we can go into it briefly here, but the earnings reserve account is the source of inflation proofing. So to the extent inflation proofing is foregone, it increases the balance of the earnings reserve account that could be used for other purposes. If you look at this chart in 16, 17, and 18, you can see there wasn't inflation proofing, and 21, there wasn't inflation proofing appropriations made. And in 16 through 18, that was really a result of some of the fiscal stress the state was experiencing. And at the same time, you saw for the first time, the historical dividend formula not being followed. And again, because of that extraordinary fiscal situation that we found ourselves in, where the price of oil went from that couple of year average of just over $100 a barrel to something around $25 a barrel in the matter of 5 months, and a $3 billion fiscal gap that widened out at that point in time, and the incredible stresses that it put on the state that ultimately resulted in the POMB construct being created in 2018 and implemented in 2019. So if you don't make that appropriation, in my view, it is breaking the compact with each one of the generations of the past that did make those appropriations and more. That if there's a deferral of inflation proofing, that can be a strategy. And in fact, our board documents include a resolution that would advise that to this body, that there should be deferral of inflation proofing when the earnings reserve balance gets to be less than four times the POMB transfer, but only done in the context of there's a plan to make up for that inflation proofing at a point in the future, because it is the basis of maintaining buying power or growing buying power, as you pointed out, Mr. Chair, into the future. If you don't inflation proof a savings account and you can right now spend a dollar out of it, well, how many, when I was a kid, you could buy a pack of bubble gum for 25 cents. And I see a pack of bubble gum now is $2. And so if you only maintain the ability to draw a dollar and don't inflation proof it, now I can't buy a pack of bubble gum anymore. And it's the same thing holds true, just larger numbers.
Okay. I know. You were going to address some of that in two slides down. I would just like the record to reflect that bubble gum used to be a nickel when I was a kid.
So this slide is designed to show some of the stress that you see on the earnings reserve account. The statutory net income is reflected in the blue bars that are above zero, and then the draws on the earnings reserve are the dividend, which is the tannish color, and then the blue is the inflation proofing or special appropriations into principal. And you can, the red line is the net impact, and so you can see there's a tension that exists in the current two account systems, and this goes to your question of a moment ago, Senator Merrick, that as the earnings reserve account balance grows to levels that are very large and seem beyond the need of our POMV construct, it becomes tempting to consider using that excess for other current generation need. There's a lot of things that we do without that would be nice to have, and it becomes very tempting when there's a pot of money that obviously has an excess balance in comparison to what is expected of it minimalistically. And so that's where the legislatures of the past, including folks sitting around the table, have done the work of their generation by segregating money and placing it into principal and taking that temptation away for both themselves as well as the legislatures which followed. And that results in the net impact of money flowing out of the earnings reserve. Then we have a really strong market performance in 2021. Our earnings reserve balance goes back up, temptations taken away again through transfer. And the difficulty of that construct is that then in a negative market experience, we have the ability to see the bottom of the pool, meaning that there's danger that we might not have enough. And so that is one of, again, the board's longstanding goals, is to move away from a two-account system with the earnings reserve account and the principal account and just have one principal account with a true POMV payout that's not reliant on earnings of that year or the legislature of that year to do the right thing. It's embedded in the construct of the fund itself. And that would be idealistically the strongest, the most impactful change that could be made to the permanent fund. At the bottom of this chart, we have the effective POMV rates. And so because we have that historical fund value formula for determining the POMV and the fund value's been increasing, the actual POMV rate has been less than the 5% minimum. It's been, as you can see, between 3.79 and 4.52%. As the fund value either stabilizes or potentially decreases in a less robust market, you'll see those numbers increasing. You're going to see those percentages increase to closer to 5. And if you had a longer time frame where the fund didn't ascend in value, then you would actually have numbers greater than 5% that would be drawn from the permanent fund as those past year's higher balances were included in the formula.
Okay. Next slide.
And this slide is, again, designed to show the bottom of the pool in the earnings reserve account. If you looked at an unaudited balance from December 31st, there's the $52 billion we talked about earlier. As principal, it has a correlated unrealized gain of $9 billion for a total value of $61 billion in the principal portion of the fund. The earnings reserve accounts has available for appropriation, that is, meaning it hasn't been committed yet to something, of $3.8 billion, and that includes the statutory net income we've received fiscal year to date through this unaudited period of December 31st, so $3.8 billion. The FY24 POMV committed to flowing out next fiscal year, $3.5 billion, and then the $4.2 billion in the current year's budget for inflation proofing that would transfer over near the end of the year. And then you have $2 billion of unrealized gains associated with the earnings reserve account. And the difficulty is that when money leaves the earnings reserve account, the unrealized gains associated with that proportional piece of the fund travel with it. And so, or I shouldn't say travel with it if it goes to principal in the case of inflation proofing, in the case of POMV, travels to principal because there's a smaller balance. It's a proportional allocation between principal and the ERA for distributing the unrealized gains. And so the reality is that there's something along the line of $11.5 billion that's available for appropriation today. And as that's appropriated, the $2 billion flows up to the principal portion of the fund. And that's not to say that it wouldn't be available for realizing those unrealized gains and having that money transfer back to the ERA. But as I want to call you Marcus, but Mr. Frampton commented earlier, our portfolio is comprised of some assets that are more liquid, some that are less liquid. And as he mentioned, but I'm not sure, it was fairly quick in on the table, was that 90% of those unrealized gains are in illiquid assets, meaning that assets that we really don't expect to have a lot of churn on, like we would in the ascending market that we had recently, where we were selling public equities at with capital gains to reallocate to other asset allocations. These are a little more sticky unrealized gains, and so it might not be as quick for it to flow over to the earnings reserve account.
Just for clarifications, make sure I heard you right. 90% is leaning towards the illiquid side, leaving 10% to the more liquid side of the earnings reserve.
Mr. Chairman, at this point in time, that's correct, and that's gonna it evolves. So January was a strong month in the equities market, and so it's gonna be a little different today. But as of that point, yes.
Okay. Questions on this slide? I'd like to have if you could help us a little bit more looking forward. I recognize your crystal ball is just that, kind of foggy in the crystal ball, and who knows what's going to come about. But we at the table here need to get some feeling for the risk exposure we have of crippling the earnings reserve account to the point where we have trouble both inflation proofing and the 5% payout. Recognizing that if push comes to shove, the inflation component would most likely be deferred into future years when performance is better. But that's not necessarily desirable, but practical. So can you help me with what kind of market conditions it would take to put us in those precarious positions?
Mr. Chairman, it's difficult to predict. Again, as was pointed out earlier, there's a lot of choppiness. And maybe this prior slide showed statutory net income. And so, I'm sorry.
Let me just rephrase the question.
Okay, sorry.
I recognize that a lot of the portfolio is illiquid and rather static, and there's appraisals quarterly for the valuation. So if the market, you know, targeting, instead of being 8%, it hits the broad market at 5% or 3% on average for the next 2 or 3 years, 7% for that matter, which would be a little bit under what we're targeting, where we should expect the range of the permanent fund to land, just trying to facilitate those goals that we have.
Mm-hmm.
And you could get back to us if you want, but
that might be a good one to get.
Yeah, and when you do that, maybe try to put it, you know, we've got the probability expectations, but try to do it in the Bugle chart in dollars. If possible. And we're, you know, again, we understand it's an estimate and we're not trying to predict the market. My concern is if we have a market that runs at 7, 6, or 5% going forward, where are we? Obviously, if it goes at 2%, we're a lot worse position than we were 4 or 5. I want to see our survival rate at anemic markets if we had them for a couple, 3 years.
And to be clear, you're referring to statutory net income rather than general market performance, since that's what drives the transfers to the ERA?
Well, it would be the general market performance and then the mechanical mechanism that boils down to our ability to, we'd have then the statutory calculation relative to the, you know, the percent of market draw, the 5%, the current construct we have unchanged, which I think we could all argue needs to be modified, but that's the world we live in. I'm trying to get the best feel for financial impacts coming at the committee if we have mediocre markets. Obviously, if we have really strong markets of both oil price and financial performance, we got a whole different set of issues to deal with here at the table versus trying to make payroll.
Yep. And I just to maybe put an exclamation point on your comment, that the first line of the lower portion of this chart is statutory net income, and you can see that range of performance as far as transfer of statutory net income to the earnings reserve account from a low in FY16 of $2.2 billion to that high that you referred to earlier of 7.9, really rounding $8 billion in 2021. And that being, in my view, one of the primary concerns of the durability of the two account system is and the difficulty in predicting, because of the lumpiness we talked about earlier, what statutory net income is going to be in the future.
Mm-hmm. Think of it then as not a prediction, but a range of expectations under certain market assumptions going forward. Senator Keel.
Mr. Chairman, I understood significant portions of that, but probably not all. And I'm just looking at slide 20. The goal of keeping the ERA balance at four times what we are going to draw out of it with the POMV. I'm just looking at inflation proofing needing more than a full year's POMV draw worth. You talked about seeing the bottom of the pool. I guess my question is, how close are we to hitting concrete when we jump?
Through the chair, Senator Keel. So we don't have a robust model like Ledge Finance does because again, it's not part of our charge. I mean, we're investing money. We're not trying to predict we can help, but we're not trying to specifically predict the range of outcomes of the future. But if there were relatively, I don't know, high inflation at 5%, and we assume the low band for Callan's return expectations, then there would be an inability to inflation proof in FY25. There would be an insufficient balance in the earnings reserve account. You'd be able to meet the POMV, but inflation proofing would not be possible. And if you went below Callan's low expectations, something more along the line that we're looking at in the current fiscal year for statutory net income, then you would be right about at the POMV transfer for the ERA balance in for 2026. So you would that's what I mean by it's not that far in the future that you can see a potential of having to make difficult decisions.
So just for the committee members and staff, a lot of the questions and presentations will be done by legislative finance versus having the permanent fund come in every time we have a question or do a different runs. They'll be working with the permanent fund. We'll be asking Ledge Finance some questions. They'll have to refer to the permanent fund for data or some runs. So we're going to integrate that process. And then, we'll, as need be, we'll bring back the permanent fund, but most of the work will be done with Ledge Finance through them. That'll also help stabilize the accuracy of the information so we don't have, multiple members asking very similar questions to the permanent fund and things like that for efficiency. But there may be a need in the future to have the permanent fund come back like they are today and put a finer point on some areas of concern as we narrow the focus over the next couple months.
This slide is designed to show the construct of the current two account system and the complexity of it, and it's an accounting complexity as well as a policy complexity that's generally described here, that you have a principal portion of the fund where the royalty deposits are made. It's where the inflation proofing and other appropriations, special appropriations are held, as well as the unrealized gains associated with that. And then the earnings reserve account where the realized income from that principal portion flow to and then are available for appropriation. But as we described earlier, there's unrealized gains that are also allocated to the earnings reserve account, and the calls on the earnings reserve account aren't necessarily, or the deposits into the earnings reserve account, I'm sorry, which was what I should have said, aren't as linear as the need for the earnings reserve account to provide, meaning that you can have a lumpiness to transfers into the earnings reserve account that then they're taking a conservative approach. The lumpiness is smoothed out from a fund balance perspective, but then you can wind up with situations where there are concerns about the potential of less than an ability to fund the inflation proofing and POMV in the future. And so, again, we talked about the board has a couple of resolutions that date back 20 years in support of a one-account system and a true endowment structure, and this is what it might look like. So a huge simplification where you would just have contributions into the Alaska Permanent Fund and then a percent of market value payment out of the Alaska Permanent Fund. There wouldn't be angst and worry about the ability of one generation to take more than their share of the wealth that the prior generation set aside on their and their children's behalf. It would just be the expectation and shift along this line, in my view, would be the single most important thing from the fund's organization that could be accomplished. And these are just other board resolutions that are available on our website. And so I think the one that I referred to earlier about the balance in the earnings reserve is that last one, 20-01. And of course, folks are obviously able to go to our website and find both that information as well as a lot more in the annual report, as well as our financial statements, as well as interim financial information that's updated monthly and performance reports. And that was our presentation today.
Okay, do we have any? Senator Murray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So getting back to the one classic endowment structure, if it's been talked about for 20 years, why hasn't it happened? What's the opposition?
Through the chair, Senator Merrick, it's a heavy lift. It requires a constitutional amendment to have an enduring endowment structure. And, of course, that takes a supermajority of the legislature as well as a vote of the residents of the state. And I think there's been an inability to look at protecting the fund first without talking about a permanent fund dividend transfer, and the permanent fund dividend is an issue that people speak of with emotion, and so it quickly becomes difficult to reach the majorities that are required.
Follow-up?
Yes.
Do you know why, when POMV was passed, the old statutory PFD formula was not repealed?
Through the chair, Senator Merrick, no.
Thank you.
As I recall, when that piece of legislation left the finance table, the dividend split was 75-25. 25% to the dividend, 75% to facilitate basic services in the state. And the discussion since then has been dividend split substantially above that. There's a few people that were below it, but not much support for below that. And that's led to the inability for us to move forward for the last few years. But that is a separate discussion, the split and the construct of a endowment style of setting the payout at 5% and reinvesting everything else that would get away from, it would lead us to not have to have the inflation proofing discussion every year or the inflation proofing appropriation every year. It would be automatic. We just need to make sure we don't set the rate at too high amount, which is another concern some of us have. It's too high right now, some of us feel, including myself. Some people probably would like it bigger. So we need to work through that. We have any final questions before we conclude today? I'd like to then thank Mr. Frampton and Mr. Mitchell for coming forward today. We'll try not to exercise your or distract you too much from managing the permanent fund as you answer questions for Ledge Finance. There'll be a few. It'll be concentrated on the viability of the earnings reserve account and then market conditions. And if there's a substantial change in market conditions, we probably want to have you guys back on that too over the next few months. We just don't know what's coming at us, but we know one thing for certain. The market's different every year, and it's not linear. So that concludes today. Tomorrow, we're going to have a meeting start at 9 a.m. And we're going to have an update from the Division of Retirement and Benefits. We'll give us an update on PERS and TERS funding. This is not the comparison analysis that we have been waiting for. That'll hopefully come the following week. This is just the start of a status of where we are today with the current structure. Where's our unfunded liability? How much have we gained or lost trying to solve that problem through appropriations? And what's the, what's their asset return base, benchmarks, all that other stuff that we deal with the permanent fund. So again, this is not the comparative analysis of the newer tiers, the defined contribution versus the defined benefit. That will be later. This is an update, setting the base of where we are today before we talk about any comparisons or any potential adjustments or changes for those, because I know it's a subject of high interest around the state, just so it's clear. So we'll see everybody here tomorrow morning, 9 a.m. We are adjourned at 10:33. We are adjourned.